Southport. That seems to have all the hallmarks of foreign interference.
That was our original thought, but it wasn't. It was actually even scarier.
Disinformation spread and tensions erupted onto the streets.
So this is a profession in destroying democracy, essentially.
We are seeing more people doing that and earning 100,000 a year.
Wow.
200,000 a year. But if you get them really riled up, they could go rioting, they could tip an election by 10, 20,000 here or there.
The media is, of course, hiding the fact that this is a 17-year-old male.
Do you feel like people are becoming more radicalized than ever before?
Yes. And when you say people, I'm thinking about people in Western countries. If the economy collapses here, we're in the same bucket.
Britain's economy is under incredible strain, more than you may realise.
You know, integration has succeeded when the white supremacists aren't white.
You posted an arson manual. Do you accept any responsibility for what you did?
Talking heads on TV, experts in the region who were getting attacked on the street, like physically attacked on the street.
In the
journalists.
UK?
Yeah.
Some men just want to watch the world burn.
I worked in Gaza.
What toll does that take on your mental health? Episode 2, What's Left? We are here today with Amil Khan. Amil, Middle East Reuters correspondent, not so long
back
ago.
Now I'm a bit old now, so it was a while ago.
BBC as well?
BBC investigative.
Undercover?
Undercover.
We're going to get into some of that later. And now, misinformation expert.
We look at manipulation, which includes disinformation.
Tell me a bit about Valent. So that's the company that you run.
After I left journalism, I was working in government looking at disinformation. My thing was informational threats. And in 2016, disinformation became a phrase. And I was working on a particular issue where it first became something that the media started talking about, which was the Syria conflict, often called the first socially mediated conflict. You know? And I was looking at the issue of the use of chemical weapons and all these accounts. And everybody's talking about misinformation, disinformation. But what I could see looking at it was that these accounts didn't look real. And the way they operated didn't look real. Like there was a structure to it. There was a methodology to it. I was like, this isn't just about fact-checking. This isn't just about saying this is right or wrong. Because what if the actors behind this don't care if it's right or wrong? And they're just using some kind of technical manipulation. So I was like, I don't want to dig into this. So I wrote a report on it. And then from the report, I ended up doing an analysis of tools available to deal with this new issue. And I found that none of the tools actually could see fake accounts or know anything about the methodology that they're using. So COVID came around and I was like, this is going to be a major issue. And my bet was that it would go into the private sector. And that was our sustainability strategy, that we would make it so that it works and people in the private sector will pay for it. But we can use it, you know, to do what we can with different organizations to clear up their bits of the information environment.
Right, so what you're saying is that banks take this problem the most seriously out of anyone because they got to protect their capital, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. But misinformation can't have just started in Syria, right? Surely it's been going on for ages.
Yeah, I mean, as long as there's been benefit to be had from manipulating people, it's always been a thing, right? The one that I often think about and talk about is active measures used by the KGB in the Cold War era. And so the one that people talk about the most is some story about AIDS that was planted by the KGB in an Indian newspaper. And then it became like a popular conspiracy theory in America, but like years later, years and years later.
And this was just a random story.
Part of like their kind of influencing. But you have to take a step back and look at it from their point of view. They saw the BBC, NBC, CNN, probably a bit before CNN. They see all of that as a Western influence operation.
That's going on, what, in the late 80s?
Yeah, about that.
So the first tactics for misinformation are getting rolled out, towards the end of the Cold War. And the way they're doing it is they're seeing it as like a long mission, right? We got to plant a story in India and wait weeks to see if there's any green shoots of
that. And to me, that's just wild, because is that with the intention of it almost funneling itself back to the West almost?
Yeah, there's a lot of bleed across between marketing strategy, general PR and politics. And when any of these methodologies are seen to work, all sorts of people jump on them, legitimate actors and illegitimate actors. So what those guys were doing is definitely thinking, we see something here that could work. the audiences they were thinking of were the audiences where you can get an outsized impact for their size. So it's a smaller audience, but if you get them really riled up, then you can. They could go rioting. They could tip an election by 10,000-20,000 here or there. The thing that really made me think now's the time to set up Valent was COVID, because you could see that there was an audience of people who were reluctant about vaccines. And it's a real audience. It's real people whose issue was around health and a certain suspicion of the science, the world of science.
Oh, yeah. I would say, to a point, some of their experiences with history as well. So it's not just conspiratorial. It's,
no.
We've had bad history.
You're talking about like minority ethnic community distrust. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why that. Yeah,
there's minority communities, and then there's like, you know, white middle-aged mums. They all, but it'll be like some real reason why at the root of it. But it wasn't shaped into a place where it could have a political impact. It's people buying Gwyneth Paltrow Goop stuff or like just talking to their friends. It's there. It's real, but it's kind of. Kind of like this kind of fuzzy cloud of feeling and views. And you could definitely see as the COVID situation was going on that there was a lot of activity going to pointed at those people to kind of shape it a bit and anti-vax and weaponize it.
I mean, it's interesting how the attitudes have shifted on anti-vax. So, I mean, I guess this is partly in light of Zuckerberg coming out and saying that they were getting directives from the government to moderate that sort of content, which makes it then seem very insidious, you know. But if you're saying what you're doing is based on science and what you're trying to do is get people to comply based on facts, seems like a necessary thing to do in the circumstances. But it's almost had this kind of long-term effect where actually, in some ways, it's created more distrust around what we're seeing online, who the authorities are on these topics. I mean, what do we do about this? This content moderation problem, like, firstly, where are we with it and how do we solve it?
Yeah, this is the big million-dollar question, isn't it? My take on, like, disinformation manipulation is a massive spectrum of activity. We've looked at, say, 20, 30 countries, and we do a mapping of their, like, all these networks of fake accounts. And we can also see then what real people are engaging with and what is just bot activity. When you look at any particular place, the UK included, extreme views are about 20%. In probably 15 to 20, so 20 when you're talking about warfare or something, it's like, you know, people are on edge. Normally it's 15%. That's the real scenario. But if you go out and ask people, what percentage of population do you think are white supremacists, let's say, and especially if you're in that group, if you are a white supremacist, they're going to think, oh, it's like, well, we're the silent majority. It's like 60, 70, 80% of us. Mm. And it's designed to do that. So what we work on, I always think of it as ink spots. We work with organizations and we go, your bit, like, you can't rely on legislation. You can't rely on the platforms doing their thing. You have to protect your ink spot. So what you have to know is what's real and what's not real and how you outcompete it. You can do takedowns. That does sometimes kind of like a bit of a fly. It's constantly like you get stuff.
Whack-a-mole.
Yeah, it comes back up, but it does impose costs on the actors. But the better thing to do is to out-compete it, because this kind of activity is really like going to the gym and taking steroids.
Is that out-competing it with ideas, with resources, with capacity?
With the truth?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's out-competing it with your ideas.
So we've got to. So if we're talking about like the negativity that we're seeing or the populist narratives that sometimes play fast and loose with truth, the way to counter that is to put loads of positive information that is truthful in the opposite direction. You've got to flood the zone in the opposite direction. Is that right?
You've got to. It is right. But the reason I'm hesitating is because, so in my professional background, when I was at Reuters, we were inculcated with the idea that if you get the truth, lots of discussions about Western media and whether or not it's biased and whatever, but that was how we were trained. Like, you get the truth, you corroborate, you get sources, you give evidence, and then you put it out there. And one of the reasons I left was, I was like, internally as an organization, we thought as soon as we do that, problem solved. You know, the truth will set you free, like, you know, the old X-Files poster. But I found it didn't. You put it out there, nobody really saw it. It didn't get into the media. And fundamentally, it wasn't a kind of distribution problem. it was an emotional resonance problem. Mm. You know, it's boring, that stuff often. And the right-wing stuff or the hard-right stuff, it doesn't have to be a particular political thing. It can be just commercial. It actually comes at it from a completely different angle. It goes, what is the outcome that we want? We want a bank to crash. We want a particular political party to be voted in, whatever it is. Okay, now what narratives do we need to make that happen with that audience? And it's kind of, we say we're content agnostic, but in the way that we look at the distribution, not the content, that's really content agnostic. Like, it just doesn't give a shit.
Do you think that's what's basically caused a broader proliferation of media and why there is cynicism outside of just the kind of methods that you're talking about, but because people now are turning to opinionated news or kind of commentary style media?
Journalism is itself, and media, news media, right, it's a wide spectrum. Like, nobody just wants objective facts all the time. You do at critical times. You do, if there was a civil war right now here in London, you would want to know which road you could go down and which road you couldn't go down, which was safe and which wasn't safe. But you still might then get to your home, your place of safety, and then listen to somebody who's totally not objective, who's a talking head, you know, rail off at the other side. Mm-hmm. And you might want that. So you're always going to get a bit of both. And I think the approach of constantly doing fact-checking of information misses the point. Like, if you're BBC and you're fact-checking bad stuff that people have been saying, the people that you really want to reach don't believe the BBC anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that fact-checking is not going to work. I think what I'd like to see, and we don't work in this space, but what personally I'd love to see is actors who aren't, like, you know, on the nasty side, being way better at storytelling.
I think that's a big problem. Yeah. I think one of the central problems the left has, kind of the reason why we set this up, was that left-wing people really struggled to storytell.
Yeah.
Like, for, and that seems really odd to me, because we've got a great story. Like, we've got a story about fairness, about justice, some moral mission. These are all things that should delight, you know, an emotional resonance with people. And yet we don't see a huge number, in the same way that the right have, of these, like, charismatic, powerful storytellers. Not to say that we are charismatic, but we're trying.
We spoke about this before, about, I think we're so oppositional to the world that we're kind of living in and the world that we're existing under, but we fail to create the narratives for something that we want to pursue and how we can get collective buy-in. So I think that's where we kind of get a shortfall, is that what are we actually just providing people as an alternative? There isn't anything really.
We can be just as negative, can't we?
Well, I think, largely speaking, the left now has become a kind of negative vacuum, and just everything's so shit.
Not just to the right, but, like, to as much to other people on the left. We eat ourselves quite a bit, don't we?
There's a lot of ideological purity.
Yes, sanctimonious.
I've seen that in a bunch of people. I've worked with rights actors, you know, in different parts of the world.
What is left to you? Like, what does it mean to be on the political left?
So, to me, it's social justice and liberal social positions. You know, if you watch Anywhere But Westminster.
Local elections here on Thursday. Are you going to vote?
Yeah.
Do you know who you're going to vote for?
No. It was Reform.
Right.
It was, but that was just purely to save the steelworks.
And often what comes out is that people go, and they're like Reform, people who are going towards Reform, and they'll, and their positions are clearly left-wing on, or and quite left-wing. Like, I want the government to, you know, support this, and I want the government to support that. But then on social issues, it's right-wing and very right-wing. And I've heard people like Steve Bannon talk about it, and they're on that. They get that, you know. They're like, you guys argue about whether you're right or left, we're going and getting some votes. I've found that people on that side of the argument will often assume that everyone is a natural fellow traveler, and if they're not a fellow traveler, it's because some bad guys have tricked them. And if we could just untrick them, you know,
then everything will be okay.
Everything's fine. And it kind of, there's a lot of assumptions then that get packed in that about how people view things, how your opponents.
Because we're like talking down to them in a certain way. If you kind of frame it like that, it's like you're not smart enough or clever enough to have figured out, you're getting duped.
Yeah.
When it can be completely legitimate for someone to complain about their area being deindustrialized.
Yeah.
That way of talking is surely just going to alienate people, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's somewhere between just saying what we think we want, what people want to hear, basically, which is what I believe and I want to say it and I want to make sure that you understand it, and if you don't understand it, then there's something wrong with you, to the let's say hard right version, which is, I don't really care what the truth is, I'm going to say some stuff and I'm going to get what I want. And if it's, you know, racist or whatever, or misogynistic, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's like ends justify the means. There's somewhere in the middle that we have to figure out where good actors have to be like, okay, how do you talk about healthcare? How do you talk about social justice in a way that actually resonates with people?
And that isn't ideological.
Sorry?
And then that isn't ideological in all of it. I think that's been some of the issues, is it's been so captured by ideology and a purism, as you said, and a subscription to these dogmatic, at times, values. We completely lose all of the people that we're designed to.
Well, most people just don't, like, they wouldn't even be able to tell you what ideology means. Do you know what I mean? So, like, choosing, like, this one lens to take to a situation actually does freeze out a bigger tent when we need, which we need to create, right?
I was volunteering in the 2019 election. I was running the comms for a Labour candidate in a constituency in London. And we were door knocking in an area that was heavily Arab. And I speak Arabic. And I was handing out these leaflets to people, knocking on doors, handing out these leaflets. And they were all like, oh, yeah, we love the candidate. We love the candidate. I heard about the candidate. It's awesome. And then a couple of times people looked at the leaflet and were kind of like, I thought, okay, what's going on here? So I looked at it and I realized that all the language in Arabic was the same language, exactly word for word, that Saddam Hussein would have used, that Bashar al-Assad would have used, because it was, because those are Arab nationalism and Arab socialism borrow heavily from lexicography of Western political thought, and just have literally translated it into Arabic.
Right.
So
the Corbynista 2019 leftist agenda just sounded like Bashar al-Assad.
Yeah, totally. Bad. And I brought that up with the candidate and other people, and I was like, this is going to put people off really badly in a way you don't understand, don't mean it. And they were like, what do you mean? So I explained it, and they were like, so you're saying that this is left-wing a language in Arabic that Saddam Hussein used and Bashar al-Assad uses? And I was like, yeah. And they were like, so what's the problem? And I was like,
ooh.
But these are people then who really feel like they know about, this is kind of what you guys are talking about. These were people who were into, and Syria was a big deal at the time, and they really felt they knew the Middle East. Maybe they'd been, like, you know, Jeremy Corbyn himself, you know, into the Middle East. But from a very specific...
Do you not think that those people are just blinded by their, like, Western hatred? Like, there's a thing of, like, we've done a lot of bad things, which we've spoken about, we know that historically they are wrong, but that doesn't mean that we're awful and evil, like, and in a singular lens. And it also doesn't mean we can't create a better future as well that is more inclusive and alive to that history, but they kind of only see us through this negative lens.
I think that's very true.
What do you mean you use ChatGPT for everything? What happened to having a think? Bring back the good old days when folk would have a think.
Can we take a case study here? So, like, Southport, right? Yeah. So these awful murders happen of these three young girls. Yeah. And then there's this, like, information gap.
Yeah.
And then the first thing that comes out is a story, I believe, originating in India or maybe Pakistan, that the killer was a migrant who'd come on a boat called Ali al-Shakati.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems to have all the hallmarks of foreign interference over it. What's your view?
So we looked at that scenario and that was our original thought. But it wasn't. It was actually even scarier. It was a grifting website set up. So what that means is, and this is becoming more and more of an issue, it's an individual, in this case it was a guy in Pakistan, who sets up a web page that is monetized through ads. And there's an AI function in that just looks out across the internet and goes, on an hourly basis, on a daily basis, what article can I generate that's going to get me the most eyes on screen and then therefore the most money because I'm monetized? And that's what it came up with.
Fucking hell. So that was just about making money.
That was just about making
money. And that led, probably was the first domino to fall, which led to those riots and people trying to burn down the silence in the hotel.
Exactly.
That is insane.
Because if it's a foreign state actor, there's
a rationalization. Like you guys are coming after us. We're in a battle.
And in all of that, I mean, who are those people that are sat in other parts of the country? I mean, are they people working on behalf of governments? Are they people who are working on behalf of massive corporations? Are they just ordinary people who want to see this disruption across various societies?
Totally all of those things. And that's the scary thing. As we, as a country here, become poorer, you'll find more people doing it here. So up to now, let's say the last 3 or 4 years, it tends to be people in relatively poorer countries doing it, aiming at Western audiences, because you get more per click for a Western
View or something.
Yeah, Western viewer, more money, bigger cost, revenue per click. So you'll get like guys in India, Nigeria, Vietnam doing this. And the trick for them then is the cultural resonance, like how to make stuff that resonates with people in a country you don't live in is hard. But now we're seeing, and also the unit economics works. If you make $200-$300 a month doing that in a country where prices are low, then you're doing well. You know,
you're making bank.
It's good money. But if you do it here, you need to make more than that for it to be worth your time. And as opportunities to earn money decrease, we are seeing more people doing that and earning $100,000 a year.
Wow.
$200,000 a year.
So it's not just
in the UK.
So it's not just an industry that some people are going to be looking to because they can't find a job, but it's also one that's going to have a bigger audience because more people are angry and wanting to believe conspiracy theories.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like a double-edged sword.
It's a horrific flywheel.
So this is a profession in destroying democracy, essentially.
Yeah, and you know, like I was saying on the extreme end, there's an outcome they want, and that's money. Democracy, best example of this, best example, I love this example, is there's an account called Inevitable West.
Yeah,
I see that.
Run in India.
Yeah, run by an Indian guy in Dubai. Talk about internationalism.
And there's another one, Radio Genoa.
Yeah.
They cosplay as if they're like some like white, British, persecuted minority, but it's an Indian guy in Dubai making loads of money off ex-advertising. Yeah.
Somebody was saying to me, You know, integration has succeeded when the white supremacists aren't white. And I thought,
actually, maybe we're fine as a society. We saw it.
Some metric, you got to get the wins where you can.
But you know what's funny about that as well is that the BBC did their investigation into the Southport stand-up Telegram chat, which was where all of this misinformation was getting pumped. And guess who was running it? A dude in like Finland? A black guy in Finland?
I didn't know that.
I'm calling the police.
Are you a neo-Nazi?
You're having a call, okay?
Mika, do you want to say anything to people in Britain? You're an administrator of the Southport Wake Up page on Telegram. You posted an arson manual. Do you accept any responsibility for what you did?
Yeah, a black guy in Finland was running an account which was essentially directing rage and anger towards migrants in the UK over the Southport murders. That's mental.
Beyond real consequences. Yeah.
This is what's really odd. I mean, if you can keep finding not just these actors, so like, let's say this guy could be anywhere from the Dark Knight, you know, when Alfred warns about the man who just wants to watch the world burn, to someone who's just trying to make some money.
Yeah.
Like, we haven't even spoken yet about actual foreign interference actors, right? We're not talking about Russia, who started developing these methods, and that they came from the KGB, and that's Vladimir Putin's background, right? He was an ex-KGB agent. And we're not even talking about China. And one of the most alarming things that I heard about Chinese interference was that they employ 2 million people to go online and put out content and media and stuff, disinformation in the West. I mean, that is 2 million people. That's like, what percentage of our workforce would that be if we were to rival that?
Yeah. And then you've got AI. And back when we started in 2020, you could find this kind of activity. We would build lists of these networks, and we still do. We just use more tech around it now. But we would see 100, 200 accounts in a network, and we would catch them by finding a sentence or two that would just be cut and pasted across like 50 web pages.
Because then you repeat it.
And now with ChatGPT, so Anthropic put out a report, and this is something that my colleagues on the tech side are thinking about right now, is that they found an actor using their Claude model to run 100 accounts in the background that read your profile. So they were trying to reach 100,000 people. And the data they're taking in is 100,000 people's profiles, where else they are,
and this is on
the internet.
X or this was Facebook.
So the network was Facebook, X, TikTok, I think, as well. This is just running in the background, doing PR for a couple of governments, a couple of commercial agencies. So Anthropic said this is a paid for operation. So likely that is a company that's just established like an advertising platform, and gone, come on, who wants to pay for this? And that will engage 100,000 people automatically and go, you know, talk to you and say, look at something you posted last week, look at your profile, look at something else you posted, look at your website maybe, and engage you in a conversation on something that specifically you are interested in, and do that 100,000 times.
Wow. And what, they're direct messaging you?
They'll engage you in a conversation. Oh, they want other people to see it.
Or like draw you into a little comment span.
They want to like create a silo.
So this is what's terrifying me, right? Because we get a lot of like bot comments on our profile, yeah, and it's like, okay, so sometimes they're racially abusing us, fine, we take on the chin. Other times they're taking gripes with like what we've said in the argument. It's quite hard to be like to know for sure, like you're kind of running off the fact that they've got like maybe like 50 followers and a black screen and stuff like that. But with AI now and LLMs, these guys are looking, every comment's going to be different. They can change every single message to sound as if they're
real. I mean, I had an experience of this about this time last year when I was standing for Parliament, and I could see these endless messages that were coming through. I had no idea. And they seemed like profiles that were coming on my account,
just
basically racially abusing me on the on the platform. But I didn't know where that, were they in the constituency I was standing in?
Yeah.
Were they people in London? Were they? And then they had very real consequences again.
Yeah.
When you're going out knocking doors and people are saying, well, you said this that you haven't said, or you've done this or you've done that, and complete mistruth, and to a point they were attached to a broader political endeavour.
Of
undermining me, of course. But, like, destroying the nature of a democratic election.
Yeah, imagine how many candidates, you know, and people who don't want to get involved because they're like, you know, I don't want
to. Well, we had, there was a thing that happened last election with Ahmed Yacoub, who was the independent candidate running in Birmingham. And his team allegedly manipulated a video of a Labour volunteer on the doorstep to insinuate that she'd said something racist, which she hadn't.
Right.
And they just put it out there. And it's like, that's got to be a criminal offence, because that woman then got dogpiled on the internet, then got messages from her school, she was a teacher, where they'd been like, you can't come in, completely upended her life.
Yeah.
As a result of a targeted misinformation campaign. I mean, surely we need to have more robust measures too.
And just adding to that as well, the increasing sophistication is also around them literally emulating people's voices. I remember sometime last year where I think there was supposedly a recording of Starmer, it wasn't Starmer, saying whatever.
Yeah, and West Streeting as well.
And it sounded so much like him, and people like myself and people like my parents who are just getting on with their lives could quite easily hear that and think, well, this is what...
So what you were facing is distraction play. There's also deception plays. A distraction play is where the target is actually an individual or a group. So we were doing work in Sudan with the previous civilian government before the fighting started. And we were helping them exactly with this kind of problem, dealing with disinformation. And the people the military regime had fallen. It was still around. It was some sort of power sharing thing. They had a whole bunch of disinformation infrastructure that they'd built over decades. And so this civilian entity was like totally didn't have the resources or this, you know, they were activists for the main part. They didn't know how to deal with this stuff. And they were getting distraction plays. So that it looked like a whole bunch of people were, you know, getting involved in a conversation, but it was really designed to keep them busy dealing with that or worrying about that. So individuals in the office were getting pictures of them at university partying. One guy I remember had been in the States and they'd found pictures of him like at a pool party having a good time, and this is Sudan, is fairly, you know, conservative place, and they were using that against him. And of course, he was worried about it and he was thinking, do I come into the office? Do I, you know, that all his time was getting taken up by that. And then there was the head of the office was a woman. So a lot of misogynistic stuff against her. But it had real world impact on the work that they could do. But when we looked at it and we did a mapping of all this activity, it was tiny. But that tiny amount of activity basically nobbled the comms unit of the Prime Minister.
Because they were just obsessed with this.
Yeah, it would be, right?
Yeah,
it would be.
I'd be hyper-personal, and it's, you know...
It only takes one or two actual real people who are a bit unhinged to act on it for it to become an issue, to become a safety issue. And that has happened in the UK, where we've seen on the issue of Ethiopia, where we've seen Ethiopia is like one of the world's biggest generators of this kind of noisy disinformation stuff, especially when the Tigray conflict was going on. And there were individuals in the UK who were like talking heads on TV, experts in the region, who were getting attacked on the street, like physically attacked on the street.
In
and
the
journalists,
UK.
Yeah. And the people doing the attacking were acting on their own accord, unhinged, and then were posting. So they'd get a friend to video, and the guy's like sitting in a cafe having a coffee, and somebody would come and throw dishwater on them or something like that and film it. And the police would be like, you know, yeah, okay, whatever, we'll do something about it. We've got other things to deal with. But that clip was going viral in Ethiopia.
Right.
And this guy's becoming famous, like, I'm standing up for Ethiopia. And
so it's almost like in less developed economies, places that are more unstable, they're seeing the real violent, chaotic end of misinformation.
Yeah.
Is that something that you think could be something that we start seeing here?
Yeah, for sure. Those are the test cases. Generally, in Western countries, we all have this idea that new things, especially when it's to do with tech, start here, start in the UK, US, Europe, and then go to other places. But for exactly the reason you've said, with manipulation, online disinformation, all that stuff, it actually happens in less developed countries because there's less controls.
Yeah, there's less regulation, so you can see how bad it can really get.
I mean, there's a reason why Cambridge Analytica learned a lot of its techniques in the Caribbean, in other places before coming to doing it in the UK. So,
with that in mind, then, I guess, how do you instill a sense of resilience? I mean, because I think everyone goes on about greater kind of knowledge and education around all of these things, and I think those are a given now. Like, we have to have a level of savviness as to how to engage and interact with these things. But what kind of tangible things can, is it up for government? Is it up for civil society?
Disinformation is in essence like a guy going to the gym and taking steroids rather than working out. So really powerful messaging is a legitimately powerful messaging is really sticky, and it's a hard thing to do, and often you'll get it wrong rather than right. Now, what a whole bunch of bad actors have decided is, screw that, it's too hard, but I can get what I want by going for fear and
division
and whatever. That's the easy way, that's the steroids way. So the example that I think of is, if you think of the Syria conflict, which I know because I worked on, all the disinformation around the white helmet. So it's like, they're a Western puppet, they're this, they're that. It gets a lot of attention and defined them in a lot of ways.
And these were the guys who are helping people.
Yeah, they go in a yeah, they were.
They were going to save people under rubble and stuff like that.
Yeah, basically they're what they call civil defense. So, you know, bomb drops, they go and get people. And they were filming what they were doing, so they became a target of disinformation, like really vociferous disinformation. I challenge anyone to watch the Netflix documentary on them and not go, oh my God, those guys are heroes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when you see it portrayed in that way, a bomb goes off, and if you're, everyone in that scenario knows, you have double tap bombs. So you have a strike, and then they wait for people to go in and they strike again. All sorts of actors do that. Syrian government's definitely doing that. And people run away after the first one, and they wait and they don't come back. You know, they know there's going to be a second. The only people going in when everybody else was going out was the white helmets, time after time after time. And when you watch that and you see these guys and you see them, you know, kissing their kids goodbye, not knowing if they're going to come back, knowing that when the bomb goes off and everyone is getting out of there, they're the only ones going in. That's powerful. You remember that.
Often when we were transporting an injured woman, man or child, they would start praying, kissing us, and thanking us. It was such a beautiful feeling. For the people who are trapped in this conflict, the White Helmets was their safety net.
Can I ask you a question? Because you've done stuff in Middle East, you do this work now, this really important work now, looking at some of the worst shit out there. Like, what toll does that take on your mental health?
I try not to look at a lot of stuff, content itself. So I guess I'm slightly saved or insulated by the fact that because we look at the distribution rather than the content. So by nature, that means I'm looking at the connection between one account and another. I don't have to go into the account and have a look. But it is something I'm quite aware of because I have colleagues who will look at the content more. And I know generally there's a lot of people who, like, if you're doing what I used to do when you're making documentaries, you might be sorting through footage and looking at hundreds of hours of footage unfiltered. That is, yeah, you need psychiatric support when you do that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I feel like in a way, because content moderation has now gone down the drain, you now have people who aren't professionals, who don't have access to psychiatric support, constantly accessing some of the most like hard to watch, you know, traumatic footage out there. And some people do this for a noble reason, right? Like they go and see every clip that's coming out of Gaza because they're like, I need to know.
Yeah.
And because this matters and I don't want to lose my sense of humanity. But in another sense, that drives them insane because the depravity of it all was just so horrifying.
Yeah. I worked in Gaza. I know Gaza pretty well. I don't watch the footage. And I have kids and I've can't control everything they do, but I highly recommend to them that they don't watch the footage. And same with family members, for exactly that reason. When you talk about radicalizing, people getting radicalized, you can get radicalized on stuff that's real and matters. But the point at which it becomes a problem is when you feel you can't do anything about it. And that's generally a thing. So you kind of have to decide how you're going to deal with that. Is it enough to, you know, get involved in a local group or whatever, or raise money?
You've obviously spoken about having volunteered in London, doing stuff, speaking in Arabic to Muslim voters. Are you Muslim? Is that your background?
Yeah.
So obviously at the last election, we saw for the first time independents get voted in, mainly off the back of a Muslim vote. Does that alarm you at all in any way? Like that people might just vote based off their faith? I mean, very legitimately in this case, they took Gaza as their number one issue at the ballot box.
Yeah.
But it seems to create a very difficult problem from the perspective of how you build broad coalitions.
Yeah.
If a group of people can just be cohered together via their religion or their ethnicity and then pushed in a certain direction, perhaps by people who from the top set the agenda or are the authorities on those things. Does that alarm you at all?
I think there's been single issue voting for a long time. That's not new. I think voting on just ethnicity or religion is not healthy for democracy. I think about that. I think of places like Lebanon and stuff like that. I wouldn't like that to be the case in the UK. But I think Gaza was and is in that last election, from what I could see, it wasn't specifically an ethnicity or race or religious, because you had all sorts of people who are like, you know, people who weren't in politics or politically driven before were saying, I'm really concerned about this issue and this is the issue I'm going to vote on, and then hassle, you know, candidates to like have a position on that. We want to be in a place where people can say, okay, that issue is really important to me and now I need to build a coalition. Because a single issue by in itself is
it's not really sufficient.
Brexit, right? Yeah. Single issue. And then what do you do afterwards?
Yeah.
And also it gets waylaid. So, you know...
We're living through the chaos of single issue voting in some ways, right?
Yeah.
Like, because that Brexit camp, that tent, was never really coherent.
Yeah.
And like America's got the same problem as well.
Yeah.
You've got people on the one hand who want to lower immigration.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you've got these like tech giants who need immigration for their high-skilled jobs, who are then working together. Then you've also got people who want to re-industrialize and then others who want to make AI become the productivity goal that cuts off those jobs. I mean, all of us seem to be delving into these inconsistencies. And I think as a left-wing movement, I mean, Javan and I have spoken about this privately, but like Gaza really matters. Mm. You know, it does really matter because it strikes to the core of that sense of where is our morality and our politics?
Yeah.
And the sense of accountability where states can just act with impunity despite all of the institutions that we've set up, despite this supposed consensus of as to how we're to treat each other. And yet there is still such little action on the part of this government, on the part of global governments that yield some power over the situation. And as you say, we're watching death and destruction on our screens daily.
It does feel like Gaza specifically and the UK's relationship with Israel is completely about to change right now. Like Smotrich and Ben-Gavir were sanctioned by the UK a couple of days ago, you know, many years too late. But it does feel like things have reached a crescendo with the starvation of the population, with how much this has been broadcasted into everybody's living room over the past 2 years, with America's blindness in some ways to the fact that they can just sanction this thing to happen, that people in this country are thinking, we're not with that.
Yeah.
That's not our ally.
Yeah.
And even those who are really concerned about anti-Semitism, which I am, are saying, you're not diffusing the problem of anti-Semitism by saying that no criticism of Israel can happen. And I think the government are wising up to that now, way too late. We've probably lost so many of these people as a result of how that's been manifested over time. But it does feel to me like something is about to change. I mean, you've been covering this region for so long. Does it feel to you like this is a changing point?
From the lens of what I see, which is the coverage and being military activity, humanitarian catastrophes as a result of them in Gaza multiple times over the last like 20 years, this is the most severe scenario that we've seen. What struck me is that the Israeli government said we're not going to allow journalists in, and that is the old school playbook. Like, you know, you close an area, you go, journalists can't come in, and we're going to control the space. And that space didn't get controlled. I think when you look at it as a whole, there are positive elements about the way our information environment is developing. For sure, the reason that I left journalism was because I could see that the BBC wasn't the arbiter of everything, you know, going on. And that's because of YouTube and other stuff. The flip side of that is manipulation. That's that stuff that we look at every day. But what were you saying there about Gaza and people's views on their government, their government's responsibilities or discrepancies between what they say and what they do is because of social media coverage. You can close down access to journalists, but you can't close down coverage anymore, which I think
is a good thing.
Is a good thing and a tricky thing because it's, especially when it's something that is so emotionally charged.
As a gamer living in Gaza, I lost my home, setup and future, and now I'm living under a tent. Yo, this video was a year before. I was trying to play Valorant inside my tent, but now I can officially say we are back to Valorant, guys. By the way, my house still destroyed. Go to a link in my bio to find my campaign to rebuild it. Maybe the situation on food was better a year ago. Now we have starvation here, but yo, who needs food when he can record like these clips? Let's be honest.
Do you feel like people are becoming more radicalized than ever before?
Yes. And when you say people, I'm thinking about people in Western countries. If you're in a country that's conflict affected, where it's poor and there is different sides going at it, then radicalization is the natural outcome of that. And I think that what used to really annoy me when I came back from the Middle East and I was in the UK, so 2007, 2008, was people had this view, oh, you went and worked in these places. And then I was working at the BBC, so we'd still go off to Sudan and Chad and places like that. You know, there's this idea that those people are like underdeveloped and, you know, poor them. And I was like, if the economy collapses here, we're in the same bucket. You know, we are in the same bucket. And that, I think, essentially is what's happening. Our economies in Western countries are income inequality is increasing, which is the main characteristic in those places. And when income inequality increases to that level, then you get all the kind of things, increased violence, increased political sort of tension.
You get revolutions, right?
Yeah, exactly.
When you have a revolution, manipulation online can be one of the most effective tools to causing maximum chaos. And I just think one thing people don't talk about is like issues like Ethiopia with like in the Tigrays, in Myanmar, in the Rohingya genocide. Can you explain a little bit about how the most nefarious actors in those situations were using online manipulation tools to then essentially do genocide?
In every one of those examples that you mentioned, the fight for public opinion is a key part of the overall conflict. And in all of those scenarios and others, the more powerful actor has been cultivating networks of accounts probably for years in quite a sophisticated way. So the one that I'm most familiar with in that scenario is Sudan and Ethiopia as well, but Sudan I've looked at since I was a Reuters journalist. So Sudan was run by military dictatorship since the 80s, And there was, like, it was part of the Arab uprisings. There was an uprising, and then you had a civilian government in place. And that civilian government was a coalition of different sort of political actors and civil society actors, including socialist groups. They struggled to recover the country. And essentially then what happened was the two military sides that had not entirely been dismantled, not gone away, that were sitting there in some kind of power sharing agreement, went at each other. And it was like two elephants fighting, and the grass being the civil society actors and the civilian government. They just got pushed aside. So the military government sort of removed the prime minister, who was a civilian prime minister. And we were doing work with that civilian government on disinformation. The other military body and the army just started going at each other, and now we're seeing complete devastation in Sudan. I think there was about 6 or 7 networks. Each of those networks had 300 or 400 accounts, and you had the military running a whole bunch of them, and the other side also running a whole bunch of them. But they were using them to discredit the civilian government, accuse them of corruption. The coverage in Sudan was something like 80% of everyone online. So Sudan's a good example, and Ethiopia, where prevailing logic would say, oh, but you're not reaching everyone. Like, most people are offline because of the nature of the development in the country. I think a big realization of a lot of dictatorial regimes in the Middle East, that they kind of ignored for many years young people who speak English. I remember I was in Egypt. The government initially allowed the internet in the 90s, in the late 90s, and I was a student around then in Egypt. Who cares about English-speaking students? Like, that's not what we're worried about. We're worried about the average...
But they're actually the most dangerous.
Yeah.
Because they can broadcast to the rest of the world what's happening.
And they will act. Yeah. You know, so students coming out into the streets. So the Egyptian government, for example, because it's last, the Egyptian regime, the military regime, its most traumatic experience of popular uprising was the bread riots in the 70s, I think. So in their head, they were like, what you really want to do is control the average man's street, make sure bread prices are okay, because if we screwed that up, then they're all going to rise up and we're stuffed.
What they didn't anticipate was like Bassem Youssef cut
their belts. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. To them, in their mentality, these guys had been literally around, a lot of them, since the 80s. They hadn't changed. They were like 80, 90 years old. And sometimes we'd have to go and talk to the censors, and the censors would just tell us, like, if you wrote this in Arabic, we wouldn't allow it. But if you wrote it in English...
So what?
Who's going to be like, well, 100,000 students? Or
but why do you think it is that these other situations where you have maybe genocide in Myanmar or in the Congo, for instance, where you also have huge levels of like death as a result of instability?
In DRC.
Why are those things not spoken about as much as other issues that happen in the world? Why can't they be captured in the public consciousness in the same way that Gaza can, for instance?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it comes down to, well, in the old days, sort of like, let's say early 2000s, it was just a simple issue of what do editors find more interesting. They're the gatekeepers. So the head of Panorama or the head of BBC News and their equivalents at Channel 4, ITV, etc. The issue as to why we care more about one and not the other, I think, comes down to, in a particular country, do you see a discrepancy between what your government says and what your government does? So I could see in Sudan that what the government, what people would see as the government's position in the UK government, let's say about sanctions or weapons or whatever, was basically in line with what people were seeing.
Is it plausible that in Myanmar, for instance, because it's like a Chinese proxy, you know, situation, China's working both sides, that they're suppressing information from getting out into the wider world in the same way that in Xinjiang, for instance, and the Uyghurs, there was just so little information that was able to be broadcasted from that situation because they have such an ironclad grip on that?
Yeah, I think one is an ironclad grip.
And how does that look like, again? Like, in terms of how does a state do that where
the exact control?
So in a place like Gaza, there's still, like, you can cut off the internet and everything, but there's surrounding states that, and Wi-Fi signal still goes across. So there's a geography to it, and there's the control. Like, if you really have the means, there is a tipping point at which you can suppress information still in the world we live in, despite all the technology. So I, from what I know about Xinjiang that China has been able to do that. If you want to make sure that you just go and arrest everyone, if you walk around with a mobile phone, they're going to get you. If you can, for mobile phones ping, so you can go find people. That's a level of control that if Israel, for whatever steps it's taken so far, cannot do in Gaza. It just, you know, you can't switch off Jordan's mobile phone.
And if they could, they would, right? Like, they didn't let any journalist in, so I'm sure they would try and stop any footage from coming out.
It seems like that, yeah, that is like what they want to do, but you just can't in that scenario. And then the British government's position, if we're talking about the UK or Western Europe or America, the British government's position on Xinjiang and now the sort of hostility towards China sort of seems... there's a logical position on that, so it doesn't raise the same kind of sense of anger, I think, amongst people, and then that means there's less to exploit out of it,
right? So there's less of a division incentive, so as a result you just see less of it. It's almost like where there is space to make people feel pull in different directions and create chaos, then you crowd in all of these other actors who might just be in it to make money.
Yeah, I think that there's some of the old journalistic rules that sort of stand here. So one is dog bites man's not a story, man bites dog is a story, right? So if China, which you think does bad stuff to people, is doing bad stuff to people, you're like, okay.
Yeah,
it's expected.
Hot kettle black.
Yeah, and but then if you're saying, oh, there's this Western aligned government, it's democratic, it's in the Eurovision Song Contest, it respects human rights, and then it's doing this, then people go, oh, hang on, now...
And we,
now
an ally, they're an ally of ours.
Yeah, now it's man bites dog scenario, and now it's more of a news story.
We want the truth!
You want the truth? You can't handle the truth. No truth handler, you! Bah, I deride your truth handling abilities!
The independent review of terrorism legislation, Jonathan Hall, I think it was actually a speech he put out, which is essentially saying that if I was a foreign actor, what I would want to do is sow division in my, you know, nemesis's polity. I want to make them question all of these basic things about reality. I want to make them think that every argument you get into, there's one side that's right and one side that's wrong. And that kind of does feel as if that's the information environment now that we're living in. How do we create more unity without being, I guess, authoritarian in a sense about like what is permissible and not permissible in the debate?
I think unity is a red herring and a dangerous one. I've grown up in a Muslim context in the UK and then worked in the Middle East, and the one thing people always ask, well, we don't have unity, don't have unity, don't have unity. When you then see people enacting or bring that unity about, you realize that when rubber hits the road, what they mean is everyone listen to me. And I think actually that wasn't a plan. So it's not necessarily unity, it's consensus, I think.
Right.
And it can be fleeting. So you can, you know, if you look at successful political movements, there's not one moment where they're successful and that's it. But then the governance bit is a whole other, you know, process of winning consensus. And consensus is a two-way process. So we were talking about ideological purity. Some people are going to have to step back from certain elements of ideological purity. They're going to have to figure out how to make alliances with people who are not like them. So Muslim communities and the gay community. Most Muslims are living in a socially conservative environment and might not feel totally comfortable with other positions that the LGBT community has. And that's one of the, I think, positives that we still have here, that you kind of have to look at that and go, okay, how do we make this work?
There's an element of,
you know, compromise. we have a common reason to make this work, and that I just use that as an example. You can imagine many
but do you feel as if that integration aspect of like disparate views and attitudes is easy? I'm finding it really difficult to help articulate, because I want all of us to get on. I mean, we all come from different ethnic minority backgrounds, but I feel like we've got a sense of like civic identity amongst us about like, okay, how do we make a system give dignity to people from wherever they come from, whatever their background, but also create a vision for like a political movement that is positive and moves in a certain direction.
Yeah.
But when I actually talk to just a normal person off the street, often what you find is that the thing that they care most about is just their group,
yeah,
and their circumstance. And I wonder, like, what do we do to create a more open and empathetic type of attitude, which says that, like, okay, I do care about Joe Bloggs from, you know, Scunthorpe, yeah, as much as I care about my boy Abdi from Brent. Do you know what I mean?
I think I know Abdi.
Yeah. You know a few.
Yeah. A few Abdis. This is a really good point, and let's push it a bit further. So, as you said, the three of us, different ethnic backgrounds, different ages, but similar sort of, like, I think we will come at it from similar civic identity. What if I said to you, I've got friends, people I've worked with that I know and respect and are trending towards reform? Yeah. And when I speak to them, there's lots of stuff we will argue about endlessly, but I'll be like, oh, you really care about your community in Gloucestershire. And then when you really get into it, you're like, oh, you are worried about this community. Mm. And on top of that, you've layered some stuff that you now believe in and I don't agree with. But at the core of it, you think rural communities are hard done by. And if we get into that, and if I can have a conversation with you about that, that will challenge me, but will, I can also challenge you, that if his assumption is everybody in London is an elite, you're all elites, but the ink spot of the worst child deprivation in the UK is the estate near my house. And he wouldn't know that.
The difficulty I think that we have is that our society's become so plural.
Yeah.
And like, there are just so many distinct groups and geographies.
I would say it's less so much so that we're more plural. I think we haven't really made the case around what that common identity is amidst all of this pluralism, where there has been such kind of demographic changes over a period of time. There has been no real effort on the part of civil society or government to make an integrative or cohesive kind of narrative, reevaluating, we spoke about this before, reinterrogating what Britain means for today, but also for the next 75 years to carry us into 2100. And politics just isn't doing enough to make the case for almost itself and the communities it's there to champion.
Yeah, because it's so easy to be divisive. There's just so many more ways to drive a wedge that's getting filled by people who want to make money off of it, to people who have an interest in sowing division.
It is very easy to do that. I completely agree. And I feel slightly disappointed when I see actors who see themselves as progressive or in social justice who then say, who just reframe it slightly and just still doing us and them.
It's also harder because the threats that are posed today are a lot more challenging than I think at any time probably throughout modern history, where if we lose, the consequences are so
democracy.
Exactly, yeah. And they're catastrophic, really. And so I get your point about the gym and doing the workouts and everything, but like, you're gonna fall, you may have an injury, you'll get it wrong, it'll take years to perfect, but in that time you're conceding ground for that person that's just getting bigger and bigger, probably marginally stronger but looks more intimidating.
I think if it is a choice between, like, you know, the far right misinformation liver king and like us doing like a natty bulk, you know, over time, if it actually, when shit goes down, the natty bulk should beat the shit out of the liver king, right? Because his strength is real. I just think we have to find out what is the true core of our society. Like, what are we trying to achieve? And if that thing is, you know, better fairness, you know, better redistribution of resources such that people aren't in absolute poverty, it is that people have dignity, no matter their...
An international accountability,
Putting
others to the standard that we want to hold ourselves. I also think...
Those are real things, though. We can build a movement around real things. Mm-hmm. That's what we can do.
There's no looking at... I always think we're in 2025. There's 75 years left until we're in 2100. It's not actually that long away. There's a likelihood that potentially me and you will still be alive by that point.
I probably won't.
We can hope.
All right, bro.
But what is that vision, that long vision for the next 75 years? And I just don't see any conversation around that. There are demographic changes. There are a whole range of kind of challenges that are being presented to democracy, to kind of community cohesion, our kind of economic institutions, all of these things.
Yeah.
And yet we're still playing by the same rule book
of
short-termism that has, I think, dogged us for the last like 40 years, whilst not really taking into account with the level of sophistication it needs all of the things that we've just spoken about.
Yeah, I tend not to believe in explanations for events that lean on the idea of one actor being totally in control. That's because of my lived and worked experience of most things just being chaotic bag of cats fighting with each other. A lot of what we've been talking about now is delegitimizing the information space. It's like nothing makes sense. Mm. I doubt anyone has gone, you know what, let's just delegitimize information. But I think that is what we end up going towards because of all these actors and what they do. Because it's short-termist, it's money and power, right? So people want money and power. And they will do whatever needs to be done to get that. The end result is what we're living through.
Well, thank you so much for that talk. That was unbelievable. Loads of food for thought for us to reflect on.
Digest.
You're very much welcome back anytime on the show. And we will be consulting you, I think, a lot in the future.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be on with you guys.